Hinshaw Insurance Law Radio is on the air. From Los Angeles, I'm Royal Oaks of ABC News and the law firm of Hinshaw & Culbertson, LLP, inviting you to join us for Hinshaw Law Radio. This program features prominent lawyers and insurance industry professionals discussing insurance and reinsurance cases, issues, and developments. Before we get started, a reminder that the information on Insurance Law Radio is provided for general information purposes only. Nothing stated in the program constitutes legal advice or creates any attorney-client relationship. You should consult directly with an attorney of your choosing if you wish to obtain any advice with respect to any claim or matter. Any views expressed are those of the guests and are not necessarily the views of Hinshaw & Culbertson, LLP, or any of its clients. And now we go to Chicago and your host for Insurance Law Radio, the co-chair of Hinshaw & Culbertson's National Insurance Services Practice Group, Scott Seaman.
Thank you, Royal Oaks, and welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to Hinshaw Insurance Law Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. This is our initial broadcast for 2019, and we have some great episodes planned for the season this year to keep you abreast of all the developments in the insurance and reinsurance world. And we begin the season by looking at some of the key decisions of 2018 and highlighting some of the key decisions that will be coming out in 2019. We are pleased to welcome our special guest, Jeff Sistrunk. Jeff is a senior insurance reporter at Law 360. He has reported on insurance law and regulation at Law 360 for the past several years. Jeff is a friend of the program, and he enlightens insurers, policyholders, practitioners, and courts all on insurance cases and developments throughout the year. So welcome back, Jeff. Thanks for joining us on Insurance Law Radio.
I'm glad to be here.
Well, there have been many cases that we could discuss from last year and also cases that are pending this year. But ladies and gentlemen, Jeff narrowed the list to three decisions in 2018 and three for 2019. So we're going to start off and topping the list of key decisions in 2018 is Keyspan. And of course, the New York Court of Appeals has determined way back to the Consolidated Edison case that based upon the during the policy period limitation in most general liability policies, that New York is a pro rata jurisdiction. And a couple years back in Viking Pump, the High Court said other language could alter the result, and in that case found that the prior insurance and non-cumulation clauses required an all sums allocation. So we move forward to 2018, and in a much watched decision, the court handed the insurers a victory in Keyspan. And Jeff, why don't you tell our audience about that case?
Sure. So as you noted, this was one of the most talked about, if not the most talked about insurance decisions of 2018. So in this case, the New York Court of Appeals refused to acknowledge an unavailability exception to the pro rata allocation formula, which as insurance counsel are aware, is often used to sort out coverage for environmental contamination and other long tail claims implicating many policy periods. So the unanimous New York High Court affirmed a state appellate panel's ruling rejecting Keyspan Gas East Corporation's call to apply the unavailability exception in this massive dispute with insurance carriers over coverage for many years of environmental liabilities. So just to recap, under a pro rata scheme, a policyholder generally has to pay a share of its own long-tail liability costs for years when it had no policies in place. But if the unavailability exception is applied, the policyholder doesn't have to cover costs incurred during periods it was unavailable to buy a specific type of insurance out in the marketplace, and instead those costs are spread among the company's insurers. So here, the New York justices agreed with Keyspan's insurer, Century Indemnity Company, that the unavailability exception is incompatible with insurance policy terms mandating pro rata allocation, namely language limiting the insurer's liability to losses and occurrences happening during the policy period. And the ruling was widely viewed as a decisive win by insurance carriers, which have long argued that the recognition of an unavailability exception would unfairly expand their liability.
Well, Well, that's exactly right, Jeff. And, of course, a couple of key things about that decision, it reaffirms the notion that generally New York is a pro rata or a default pro rata allocation because, in that case, the policies did not have non-cum clauses and it was a pro rata allocation. And as you mentioned, insurance unavailability really is a key battleground now in pro rata jurisdictions. Most courts coming down the way the New York Court of Appeals did and rule that the policyholder is responsible for years when insurance is unavailable. And that could be toward the end of a coverage block, like post-1985, when generally absolute pollution exclusions and many policies to asbestos defendant companies had asbestos exclusions, that those periods are the responsibility of the policyholder, as are periods of time earlier on when they had no liability insurance or had relatively low limits of liability insurance. So a big win for the insurers and Keyspan. And the next case is actually two decisions. You got a little tricky on us there and put another one in there, but they're two decisions dealing with the subject of fishing, and that's fishing with a PH rather than fishing with a pole. So, Jeff, why don't you tell us about those decisions from the U.S. Courts of Appeal for the Second and the Sixth Circuits?
Sure. So these two federal appeals courts granted back-to-back wins to policyholders this past summer. They ruled that two companies' losses to email-based phishing theft schemes triggered the insurer's coverage obligations under computer fraud policies. So Second Circuit panel of that court kicked things off on July 6th. When it upheld a lower court's decision that federal insurance company must cover a $4.8 million loss that a company called Metadata Solutions Incorporated suffered when it was tricked into wiring money overseas by fraudsters who posed as Metadata's president in a series of email messages. And then a week later, a Sixth Circuit panel reversed a lower court's decision and ruled that Travelers Casualty Insurance Company of America has to cover more than $800,000 that a tool manufacturer, American Tooling Center Incorporated, lost in a similar scenario to that in the Metadata case when thieves posing as a vendor used fraudulent emails to deceive the company into wiring money to a sham bank account. So these two cases illustrate a trend that has arisen in the coverage space. Courts are grappling with these new exposures under legacy policy language that, may have been written before, a certain type of exposure here, these phishing or another term for it is social engineering cases became prevalent. So both appellate panels rejected the insurer's contentions that the computer fraud provisions in question were designed to cover only instances of direct hacking into policyholders' computers and not these manipulative email-based schemes. So this could be an instance where, as the marketplace catches up, there might be new exclusions written into policies, these computer fraud policies, to avoid results like you saw here. And at the same time, you might also see carriers offering computer fraud policies that are specifically designed to cover these exposures, which is already the case with several insurance carriers.
And Jeff, were these commercial crime fraud policies, both of them?
Yes. And they were written on, I believe, fairly standard forms didn't specifically touch on the exposure of phishing or social engineering losses.
And what's interesting, of course, is we still don't have a groundswelling of decisions in the context of cyber and phishing claims, but we've got a couple of things going on. We've got a mounting body of decisions under more traditional general liability and first-party all-risk policies that in the former are analogous to any other sort of coverage B type analysis, and a lot of coverage defenses when cyber claims are presented against those policies. And then when you have various generations of cyber-related policies, before we've gotten a lot of court decisions, we've actually had the insurers writing that coverage modify their forms sometimes multiple times. So we're not having yet that body of precedent matching up, and we're seeing companies as they're experiencing a claims history continuing to modify the policy forms to reach that right level of providing coverage and value in the product and yet limiting their exposure in ways that make sense. So I think we're going to be talking about cyber coverage issues, Jeff, probably for decades to come.
Absolutely.
So we go to the last and final of your key decisions from 2018, and the issue of whether defective construction constitutes an accident or occurrence has been subject to decisions all across the United States, and the Ohio Supreme Court weighed in on the issue last October, correct?
That's right, and this is an issue that as practitioners are well aware, has been kicking around in the courts for decades. And here, as you noted, the Ohio Supreme Court went back and clarified its past precedent and stretched it a little bit into the context we had here. So the Ohio Supreme Court ruled in October that damage from a subcontractor's faulty work isn't an accident triggering an insurance or an insurer's defense obligation. They spurned a nationwide trend favoring coverage for such claims and reinstating a lower court's ruling that a builder wasn't covered for litigation over alleged construction defects at a hotel on Ohio Northern University's campus. So what the Ohio High Court did here is they concluded that the reasoning of the court's 2012 decision in Westfield Insurance versus Custom Agri Systems, in which it found that property damage stemming from a policyholder's own defective work isn't an accidental occurrence giving rise to an insurer's duty to defend. They said that Westfield's reasoning applies with equal force to damage tied to the shoddy work of a policyholder's subcontractors. So more specifically, applying Custom Agri or Agra, the state justices held that Cincinnati Insurance Company has no duty to defend a general contractor called Charles Construction Services Incorporated in a lawsuit accusing Charles and its subcontractors of performing deficient work on a luxury hotel and conference center at ONU. The ruling kept Ohio among four states whose high courts have held that damage resulting from defective work is not an accident, according to a recent survey of courts' findings on that issue. And conversely, that report found that the top courts or lawmakers of 26 states have said that damage stemming from subcontractors' shoddy work can constitute an occurrence. So it's an issue that, as we've discussed here, is continuing to be litigated, and I imagine it will continue in the future until we get a definitive answer out of all
the states, and we certainly are working towards that at end with, as you note, many decisions on the issue. Well, I have to thank you, Jeff. There are a lot of cases you could choose from. 2018 was a busy year by courts rendering coverage rulings, and I think you picked out three excellent decisions. But let's look ahead and look in key decisions coming up in 2019. And the first of those cases actually is scheduled for oral argument today. And this is a case that I would say set shockwaves throughout the industry because all of a sudden the claims adjuster who's pulling in, I don't know, 50, 100, 125,000 a year, whatever it may be, now faces mega millions, if not more, in exposure in the state of Washington. So, Jeff, why don't you fill us in on what's happening in the state of Washington that's got everybody's attention?
Certainly. So, it was actually this morning, February 26th, Washington State's High Court heard oral arguments in the case of I'm going to try my best here. Kiyodela versus Allstate Insurance Company. And Allstate,
well done. I was avoiding mentioning the case because I didn't figure I would pronounce it correctly.
Well, I'm sure I'm at least a few hairs off on the pronunciation there. So it's at least judging from the volume of amicus filings, very high-stakes matter. Allstate and one of its adjusters there in Washington, named Tracy Smith, are challenging an appellate panel's ruling that insurance adjusters can be found individually liable for bad faith and breaches of the state's consumer protection law. So going back in time, just providing a little background, in March 2018, panel of Washington's State Appeals Court overruled a trial court's decision and found that Allstate policyholder Moon Kiyodela could file an individual bad faith claim against Allstate's adjuster, Ms. Smith, in a dispute over coverage for an auto accident. The panel said that relevant state law makes no distinction between corporations and individuals when it comes to asserting a cause of action for bad faith. And as I noted, the case has attracted a number of amicus briefs from concerned insurance industry groups, defense counsel groups, and I believe GEICO also weighed in as an amicus. The American Insurance Association and several other property and casualty insurance trade organizations, for example, argued in a joint brief they filed that the imposition of individual liability on adjusters is, quote, an excessive means of regulating insurer conduct and encourages litigation. So as you can tell from that, the stakes of the case are high for insurers and adjusters doing business in the state of Washington.
So, Jeff, we return to, you know, core issues that we seem to come back to a lot, which are issues of trigger allocation and unavailability of insurance. And the Connecticut Supreme Court is expected to weigh in on those issues in the Vanderbilt case. And that's a name I could pronounce, so I did. Jeff, why don't you give us the 411 on that decision?
Certainly. So the Connecticut Supreme Court, as you mentioned, is poised to weigh in on a number of issues that frequently come up in asbestos, environmental, and other long-tail claims, including the proper trigger of coverage, the application of the pollution exclusion, and the aforementioned unavailability exception that also came up in the Key Span case in New York. And all these questions came up in Vanderbilt Minerals LLC's long-running battle with a group of excess insurers over coverage for thousands of asbestos injury claims. So let's focus on the unavailability exception, which is arguably the most contentious issue being reviewed by the Connecticut justices. In this case, in contrast to the Key Span matter, a panel of the State Appeals Court in Connecticut determined that the state's law permits such an exception to the pro rata allocation formula. So here the panel applied the rule because Vanderbilt was unable to get coverage after 1985 for individuals' claims for asbestos injuries allegedly caused by exposure to Vanderbilt's industrial talc. The excess insurers are arguing on appeal to the Connecticut Supreme Court that the adoption of an unavailability exception here flouts the clear language of Vanderbilt's policies and creates an unfair outcome for the insurers by forcing them to cover injuries that occurred outside their policy periods. And according to the insurers, the exception would effectively provide Vanderbilt coverage it didn't pay for. In contrast, it's Vanderbilt's position that a rejection of the unavailability exception under these circumstances would undermine the very reason why courts originally choose pro rata allocation in the first place. And they characterize those that reason as maximizing insurance resources, distributing the burdens fairly, incentivizing insurers to continue issuing coverage, and incentivizing policyholders to buy asbestos coverage when it's available. So it'll be interesting to see whether the Connecticut Supreme Court affirms the appeals panel on that issue or if it follows Key Span, another insurer-friendly decisions on this subject. But One thing's for certain, I think everybody on both sides of the bar will be hoping for a decision that's a little more concise than the 150-plus page ruling that the appeals panel issued in this case.
Yeah, that definitely caused some trees their lives, no question about that. And hopefully the insurers obviously have the right argument. Hopefully the Connecticut Supreme Court will see it that way and reverse on the ground with respect to the issues of allocation and unavailability. Well, Jeff, most of our listeners are familiar with the musical group Guns N' Roses. The last of your top three cases to watch in 2019, let's call it Guns and Occurrences.
Yeah, so that's an apt way to characterize the issues in this case. Yeah, so it's, you know, a very interesting set of facts, to say the least. So the Pennsylvania Supreme Court is going to consider the outer limits of what constitutes an accidental occurrence as it weighs Erie Insurance Exchange's challenge of the state appeals panel's ruling that the insurer is required to defend a gunman's estate amid claims by a man who was shot in a scuffle with the late policyholder upon walking in on a homicide, suicide, and oral arguments in that case are set for April 11th. And so just going back over the history a little bit, in November 2017, so it's been a while since the appellate panel issued its ruling, the panel held that Erie must defend the estate of a man named Harold McCutcheon in a lawsuit brought by Richard Carley, who was shot in the face when McCutcheon's gun discharged during the struggle between the two men back in September 2013. The fight took place after McCutcheon had shot and killed Terry McCutcheon, his ex-wife, and Mr. Carley's girlfriend, and Mr. McCutcheon had subsequently taken his own life after wounding Mr. Carley. So the appeals panel said that Carley's allegations that McCutcheon's gun had fired accidentally during the fight defeated Erie Insurance Exchange's efforts to deny the McCutcheon estate a defense based on policy language excluding intentional acts from coverage. So Erie has told the Pennsylvania Supreme Court Carley's injury didn't result from an accident under any common understanding of the term, while Carley has argued that the accidental discharge of the gun fulfilled the requirement of an accidental occurrence. And several amicus parties have weighed in this case as well. The insurance industry, Amici, has suggested that a decision affirming the appellate panel could potentially incentivize, you know, these types of intentional torts, you know, by allowing policyholders to pass the buck to their insurance carriers. So while the case involves what could be described as unique or extreme facts, it's possible that the Pennsylvania Supreme Court's treatment of the occurrence issue may influence the outcomes of other cases involving instances of alleged intentional conduct by policyholders. So we'll just have to stay tuned and see how narrowly or broadly the Pennsylvania High Court treats this issue.
Well, here, of course, on Insurance Law Radio, we look at guns, but we focus on the coverage aspects and avoid the Second Amendment issues. So these are some of the cases to watch in 2019. And if you follow Jeff in Law 360, you will find out how the courts decide these cases, and you will also learn of other interesting decisions. And whether you follow Law 360 regularly or not, we're going to try and drag Jeff back in here this summer to find out what happened in these cases and talk about other critical coverage decisions coming down in 2019. Jeff, thank you so much for joining us on Insurance Law Radio. We look forward to reading your articles and to seeing you back here with the microphone later in the year.
Absolutely. It was a pleasure.
We want everybody to tune into our next episode. I'm not going to tell you what it's about. We'll leave you with a little bit of a teaser. It will have an international flair. This is Scott Seaman thanking you for joining us. We look forward to bringing you the next episode of Hinshaw Insurance Law Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Take us home, Royal Oaks.
You've been listening to Hinshaw & Culbertson LLP's Insurance Law Radio. The information contained in this program is provided solely for general informational purposes and does not constitute legal advice. For information on past and upcoming Insurance Law Radio programs, visit the Insurance Services Practice Group page of www.hinshawlaw.com. This is Royal Oaks thanking you for joining us and inviting you to join us for the next episode of Insurance Law Radio.